Chapter 2. Country within a circumference of a few miles, making literary calls on my brother authors. Dr. Dewey would be within ray reach, at the foot of the Taconic. In Stockbridge, yonder, is Mr. James G.P. R. James, conspicuous to all the world on his mountain pile of history and romance. Longfellow, I believe, is not yet at the Oxbow, else the winged horse would neigh at him. But here in Lenox I should find our most truthful novelist, Miss Sedgwick, who has made the scenery and life of Berkshire all her own. On the hither side of Pittsfield sits Herman Melville, shaping out the gigantic conception of his white whale, apostrophe while the gigantic shadow of Greylock looms upon him from his study window. Another bound of my flying steed would bring me to the door of Holmes, whom I mentioned last, because Pegasus would certainly unseat me the next minute, and claim the poet as his writer. Apostrophe, apostrophe, while at Pittsfield, Mr. Melville was induced to enter the lecture field. From 1857 to 1860 he filled many engagements in the Lyceums, chiefly speaking of his adventures in the South Seas. He lectured in cities as widely apart as Montreal, Chicago, Baltimore, and San Francisco, sailing to the last-named place in 1860 by way of Cape Horn, on the Meteor, commanded by his younger brother, Captain Thomas Melville, afterward governor of the Sailor's Snug Harbor at Staten Island, N.Y. Besides his voyage to San Francisco, he had, in 1849 and 1856, visited England, the continent, and the Holy Land, partly to superintend the publication of English editions of his works, and partly for recreation. A pronounced feature of Melville's character was his unwillingness to speak of himself, his adventures, or his writings in conversation. He was, however, able to overcome this reluctance on the lecture platform. Our author's tendency to philosophical discussion is strikingly set forth in a letter from Dr. Titus Munson Cone to the latter's mother, written while a student at Williams College over 30 years ago, and fortunately preserved by her. Dr. Cone enjoyed the friendship and confidence of Mr. Melville during most of his residence in New York. The letter reads, "I have made my first literary pilgrimage, a call upon Herman Melville, the renowned author of Typee, apostrophe etc. He lives in a spacious farmhouse about 2 miles from Pittsfield, a weary walk through the dust. But it has well repaid. I introduced myself as a Hawaiian American, and soon found myself in full tide of talk, or rather of monologue. But he would not repeat the experiences, of which I had been reading with rapture in his books. In vain I sought to hear of Typee and those paradise islands, but he preferred to pour forth his philosophy and his theories of life. The shade of Aristotle arose like a cold mist between myself and Fayaway. We have quite enough of deep philosophy at Williams College, and I confess I was disappointed in this trend of the talk. But what a talk it was! Melville is transformed from a marquis into a gypsy student, the gypsy element still remaining strong within him. And this contradiction gives him the air of one who has suffered from opposition, both literary and social. With his liberal views, he is apparently considered by the good people of Pittsfield as little better than a cannibal or a beachcomber. Apostrophe, apostrophe, his attitude seemed to me something like that of Ishmael, but perhaps I judged hastily. I managed to draw him out very freely on everything but the Marquesas Islands, and when I left him, he was in full tide of discourse on all things sacred and profane. But he seems to put away the objective side of his life, and to shut himself up in this cold north as a cloistered thinker. Apostrophe, apostrophe, I have been told by Dr. Cone that his father, the Rev. Titus Cone, of the Hawaiian Islands, personally visited the Marquesas group, found the Typee Valley, and verified in all respects the statements made in Typee. It is known that Mr. Melville from early manhood indulged deeply in philosophical studies, and his fondness for discussing such matters is pointed out by Hawthorne also, in the English notebooks. His habit increased as he advanced in years, if possible. The chief event of the residence in Pittsfield was the completion and publication of Moby Dick, or The Whale, in 1851. How many young men have been drawn to sea by this book is a question of interest. Meeting with Mr. Charles Henry Webb, John Paul, the day after Mr. Melville's death, I asked him if he were not familiar with that author's writings. He replied that Moby Dick was responsible for his 3 years of life before the mast when a lad, and added that, while gamming on board another vessel, he had once fallen in with a member of the boat's crew which rescued Melville from his friendly imprisonment among the Typees. While at Pittsfield, besides his own family, Mr. Melville's mother and sisters resided with him. As his four children grew up, he found it necessary to obtain for them better facilities for study than the village school afforded. And so, several years after, the household was broken up, and he removed with his wife and children to the New York house that was afterwards his home. This house belonged to his brother Alan, and was exchanged for the estate at Pittsfield. In December, 1866, he was appointed by Mr. H. A. Smith, a former traveling companion in Europe, a district officer in the New York Custom House. He held the position until 1886, preferring it to indoor clerical work, and then resigned, the duties becoming too arduous for his failing strength. In addition to his philosophical studies, Mr. Melville was much interested in all matters relating to the fine arts, and devoted most of his leisure hours to the two subjects. A notable collection of etchings and engravings from the old masters was gradually made by him, those from Claude's paintings being a specialty. After he retired from the Custom House, his tall, stalwart figure could be seen almost daily tramping through the Fort George District or Central Park, his roving inclination leading him to obtain as much outdoor life as possible. His evenings were spent at home with his books, his pictures, and his family, and usually with them alone. For, in spite of the melodramatic declarations of various English gentlemen, Melville's seclusion in his latter years, and in fact throughout his life, was a matter of personal choice. More and more, as he grew older, he avoided every action on his part, and on the part of his family, that might tend to keep his name and writings before the public. A few friends felt at liberty to visit the recluse, and were kindly welcomed, but he himself sought no one. His favorite companions were his grandchildren, with whom he delighted to pass his time, and his devoted wife, who was a constant assistant and advisor in his literary work, chiefly done at this period for his own amusement. To her he addressed his last little poem, The Touching Return of the Sire de Nisel. Various efforts were made by the New York literary colony to draw him from his retirement, but without success. It has been suggested that he might have accepted a magazine editorship, but this is doubtful, as he could not bear business details or routine work of any sort. His brother Alan was a New York lawyer, and until his death, in 1872, managed Melville's affairs with ability, particularly the literary accounts. During these later years he took great pleasure in a friendly correspondence with Mr. W. Clark Russell. Mr. Russell had taken many occasions to mention Melville's sea tales, his interest in them, and his indebtedness to them. The latter felt impelled to write Mr. Russell in regard to one of his newly published novels, and received in answer the following letter. July 21, 1886. My dear Mr. Melville, your letter has given me a very great and singular pleasure. Your delightful books carry the imagination into a maritime period so remote that, often as you have been in my mind, I could never satisfy myself that you were still amongst the living. I am glad, indeed, to learn from Mr. Toft that you are still hale and hearty, and I do most heartily wish you many years yet of health and vigor. Your books I have in the American edition. I have Typee, Amu, apostrophe Redburn, and that noble piece Moby Dick. Apostrophe these are all I have been able to obtain. There have been many editions of your works in this country, particularly the lovely South Sea sketches, but the editions are not equal to those of the American publishers. Your reputation here is very great. It is hard to meet a man whose opinion as a reader is worth leaving who does not speak of your works in such terms as he might hesitate to employ, with all his patriotism, toward many renowned English writers. Donna is, indeed, great. There is nothing in literature more remarkable than the impression produced by Donna's portraiture of the homely inner life of a little Brixford castle. I beg that you will accept my thanks for the kindly spirit in which you have read my books. I wish it were in my power to cross the Atlantic, for you assuredly would be the first whom it would be my happiness to visit. The condition of my right hand obliges me to dictate this to my son, but painful as it is to me to hold a pen, I cannot suffer this letter to reach the hands of a man of so admirable genitus as Herman Melville without begging him to believe me to be, with my own hand, his most respectful and hearty admirer, W. Clark Russell. It should be noted here that Melville's increased reputation in England at the period of this letter was chiefly owing to a series of articles on his work written by Mr. Russell. I am sorry to say that few English papers made more than a passing reference to Melville's death. The American press discussed his life and work in numerous and lengthy reviews. At the same time, there always has been a steady sale of his books in England, and some of them never have been out of print in that country since the publication of Typee. One result of this friendship between the two authors was the dedication of new volumes to each other in highly complimentary terms. Mr. Melville's John Marr and Other Sailors, of which 25 copies only were printed, on the one hand, and Mr. Russell's An Ocean Tragedy, on the other, of which many thousand have been printed, not to mention unnumbered pirated copies. Beside Hawthorne, Mr. Richard Henry Stoddard, of American writers, specially knew and appreciated Herman Melville. Mr. Stoddard was connected with the New York Dock Department at the time of Mr. Melville's appointment to a custom house position, and they at once became acquainted. For a good many years, during the period in which our author remained in seclusion, much that appeared in print in America concerning Melville came from the pen of Mr. Stoddard. Nevertheless, the sailor author's presence in New York was well known to the Literary Guild. He was invited to join in all new movements, but as often felt obliged to excuse himself from doing so. The present writer lived for some time within a short distance of his house, but found no opportunity to meet him until it became necessary to obtain his portrait for an anthology in course of publication. The interview was brief, and the interviewer could not help feeling, although treated with pleasant courtesy, that more important matters were in hand than the perpetuation of a romancer's countenance to future generations. But a friendly family acquaintance grew up from the incident, and will remain an abiding memory. Mr. Melville died at his home in New York City early on the morning of September 28, 1891. His serious illness had lasted a number of months, so that the end came as a release. True to his ruling passion, philosophy had claimed him to the last, a set of Schopenhauer's works receiving his attention when able to study. But this was varied with readings, in the Mermaid series of old plays, in which he took much pleasure. His library, in addition to numerous works on philosophy and the fine arts, was composed of standard books of all classes, including, of course, a proportion of nautical literature. Especially interesting are 15, or 21st editions of Hawthorne's books inscribed to Mr. and Mrs. Melville by the author and his wife. The immediate acceptance of Taipei by John Murray was followed by an arrangement with the London agent of an American publisher for its simultaneous publication in the United States. I understand that Murray did not then publish fiction. At any rate, the book was accepted by him on the assurance of Gansevoort Melville that it contained nothing not actually experienced by his brother. Murray brought it out early in 1846 in his colonial and home library as a narrative of a 4 months' residence among the natives of a valley of the Marquesas Islands, or a peep at Polynesian life, apostrophe, or, more briefly, Melville's Marquesas Islands. Apostrophe, apostrophe, it was issued in America with the author's own title, Taipei, apostrophe, and in the outward shape of a work of fiction. Mr. Melville found himself famous at once. Many discussions were carried on as to the genuineness of the author's name and the reality of the events portrayed, but English and American critics alike recognized the book's importance as a contribution to literature. Melville, in a letter to Hawthorne, speaks of himself as having no development at all until his 25th year, the time of his return from the Pacific. But surely the process of development must have been well advanced to permit of so virulent artistic a creation as Taipei. Apostrophe, apostrophe, while the narrative does not always run smoothly, yet the style for the most part is graceful and alluring, so that we pass from one scene of Pacific enchantment to another quite oblivious of the vast amount of descriptive detail which is being poured out upon us. It is the varying fortune of the hero which engrosses our attention. We follow his adventures with breathless interest, or luxuriate with him in the leafy bowers of the happy valley, apostrophe, surrounded by joyous children of nature. When all is ended, we then for the first time realize that we know these people and their ways, as if we too had dwelt among them. I do not believe that Taipei will ever lose its position as a classic of American literature. The pioneer in South Sea romance for the mechanical descriptions of earlier voyagers are not worthy of comparison. This book has as yet met with no superior, even in French literature, nor has it met with a rival in any other language than the French. The character of Fayaway, apostrophe, and, no less, William S. Mayo's Kalula, apostrophe, the enchanting dreams of many a youthful heart, will retain their charm, and this in spite of endless variations by modern explorers, in the same domain. A faint type of both characters may be found in the Suriname Yeriko of Captain John Gabriel Stedman, whose narrative of a 5 years' expedition appeared in 1796. Taipei, apostrophe, as written, contained passages reflecting with considerable severity on the methods pursued by missionaries in the South Seas. The manuscript was printed in a complete form in England, and created much discussion on this account, Melville being accused of bitterness, but he asserted his lack of prejudice. The passages referred to were omitted in the first and all subsequent American editions. They have been restored in the present issue, which is complete save for a few paragraphs excluded by written direction of the author. I have, with the consent of his family, changed the long and cumbersome subtitle of the book, calling it A Real Romance of the South Seas, apostrophe, as best expressing its nature. The success of his first volume encouraged Melville to proceed in his work, and Amu, apostrophe, the sequel to Taipei, appeared in England and America in 1847. Here we leave, for the most part, the dreamy pictures of island life, and find ourselves sharing the extremely realistic discomforts of a Sydney whaler in the early 40s. The rebellious crew's experiences in the Society Islands are quite as realistic as events on board ship and very entertaining, while the whimsical character, Dr. Long Ghost, next to Captain Ahab in Moby Dick, apostrophe, is Melville's most striking delineation. The errors of the South Sea missions are pointed out with even more force than in Taipei, and it is a fact that both these books have ever since been of the greatest value to outgoing missionaries on account of the exact information contained in them with respect to the islanders. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.